Hello and welcome back to another episode of Impact Factor. I am your host, Katie Van Aken, and this week I had the absolute pleasure of talking to a former lab mate of mine who was just recently named to Drexel's list of 40 under 40, and she was nice enough to share with us her journey, and we get to find out a little bit of what she's doing now. So without further ado, I give you Kathleen Molesky, PhD. Kathleen, you and I, just to set the scene here, we were in grad school together in the same lab. You're actually the first Gagatsi lab member to be on the show.
Really?
Yes.
Because
I've been trying to diversify. I'm trying to diversify the like subject expertise, you know, so I'm trying to stay away from the material science. Not working, but So, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, let's start. Let's start with your undergrad, I guess. So, yeah. Jump in.
I went to a small liberal arts school in Chestertown, Maryland, called Washington College. And I majored in physics. And I actually... Katie, we played soccer against each other, remember?
Yeah.
Undergrad.
Crazy. Yeah. I've had a lot of soccer players on the show, actually.
But we didn't know each other yet.
I know. It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. I love that.
Yeah, but I majored in physics and...
Did you do research in undergrad?
I did, but not at my school. I went to Penn State. And did like a summer internship in their material science department and just loved it. I was doing computational science though, didn't like that. I really liked material science in general. So I knew I wanted to do that. I just didn't know how to do it. So went back and graduated and then was looking for grad school opportunities. That's how I found Drexel.
Yes. So this is interesting. So your story at Drexel is interesting too, because you started as a master's student.
Yeah. And funny enough, there was a question I think that you posed about like, why'd you want to do a PhD? I didn't want to do a PhD. I actually had heard like a lot of bad things about a PhD and was really scared of it and was like, I don't want to spend 5 or 6 years of my young adulthood doing something that people say is horrible. Yeah. Then also... heard some things about people that are PhDs in industry being really overqualified and like arrogant and mean and just like, I just didn't know why I would want to do that, especially if I wanted to go into industry. So I started as a master's student and quickly realized that I really liked what I was researching even as a master's student and was like, I think I want to do a PhD in this. Like, I like this group. I like my advisor. I like the topic. I like Drexel. I like Philly. Like, why not?
Mm-hmm. And you highlighted all the right things, right? Like, typically with a master's program, it's 2 years. You might do a thesis project, and you might be associated with a lab for a short period of time, right? But if you're feeling at the end of a year that you want to do more than just a year more, you know, that's pretty good intuition that you could do a PhD.
Yeah. And you know, it's like also the finance part. If I'm doing the same thing, almost the same thing as a PhD student, and I really like it, then why not go for, you know, a scholarship or, you know, get a salary or whatever they call it these days. And, you know, actually invest in it. Versus sitting back and paying it for it myself and working a couple jobs and outside of grad school.
Yeah.
So there was like the finance part of it. If it made sense and it was something I liked, if the finances were available, then why not?
And what did the fact that you started as a master's, did that do anything to the like timing and schedule of your experience?
Yeah, it sped it up a little bit. So I was on the schedule of like I didn't even do that year. So I was basically the group that I was with was like, okay, you already finished, half your classes. So once you get done your classes, just go do your candidacy. So I was basically kind of an intermediate between two incoming classes, just because of that. I was a new PhD student, but I already had a year under my belt of classes. So they were
And you
kind
sort
of
of
like,
front loaded your classes because you were taking more
yeah,
than a normal PhD student, right?
exactly. Yeah. So I was a little ahead, but I was also a little behind. I was a little ahead in classes. I was behind on research. But that first year, I don't think that that really impacted me too much. So worked out.
Yeah, it did. I think it all balances out eventually. I mean, you can conceive of a PhD program where you don't do any research for the first year and you just take classes. I mean, that's essentially what you did. So,
Exactly.
we'll get to the how you feel about that. I'm interested that you were basically advised not to do it.
It was personal, people that I had known that were in industry that I looked up to, my parents, their friends, some of my mentors, and just my personal opinion about like spending that much time in school. And so it was, yeah, it's, I look back on that and I'm like, wow, I was told, like, I had thought something totally different than what I experienced.
Yes, and some people are have the reverse, right? They're
Oh,
encouraged to
yeah.
do it and it's miserable. And so it's a very independent experience and journey, and that's what makes it hard, but also very thrilling too, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm gonna ask you a question. I know the answer too, but that's okay. So what was your research group like?
So,
And
oh yeah,
did you
go ahead.
enjoy being in a big group?
Yeah. My group was big and there was kind of a normal distribution in my, let's say I had 5 years of PhD. There was like a normal distribution of people in that 5 years where the middle, there was like, at one point, I swear there was like 60 people. I don't know if there was actually 60, but like, I feel like there were 60.
It felt like that.
Yeah, there was
Was that
just
when I
so
was still
many.
there?
That was like the year, I think it was the year
Probably.
after. You were 2 years,
Okay.
I think you were 2 years in front. I don't know.
2017, I left.
Okay, yeah, so 2-ish years. Yeah, so my third year, I was like, there are so many people. And that was like the year where I felt like I was starting to, get a hang of what PhD was and mentoring people, starting to mentor people. And I was writing papers of my own and had a lot going on. And there was just so many people. And I'm like, there's, but I think it came down to, all those people weren't doing the same thing. So there was like some organization where we might overlap, but we have separate tasks. We have separate research directions. And like I'm researching, how to disperse a material in solvents. Somebody else might be researching how to put that ink on a substrate. We can work together and maybe make a paper together, but in general, we're still doing two different things. And that was really important with a large group is being independent enough that you felt like you were still contributing, but being together enough where you felt like you were a part of the team. And
Yeah, and like owning the thing that you're bringing to the table, right? Like in
yeah.
that paper, the value you're bringing as far as like attaching to a substrate is a key part of the paper, and so that, not you, but in general, like therefore it's valuable, you know?
Yeah. And then we had a lot of group meetings, which at the time I was really overwhelmed by. Like there was just so many, like, okay, this day we're having electrochemistry meeting, this day we're having synthesis meeting, this day we're having group meeting, which is everybody. But I think it prepared me for what I was going to go into in industry, because in industry it's about 10 times worse. So you have, I mean, I have so many meetings all the time, and I have to prioritize which ones I need to be at, but also which ones do I need to prepare for? Which ones am I going to be talking in? And so even though it was overwhelming at the stage of PhD life and there were so many people and you had to coordinate and you had to really talk through your research, only prepared you for what was probably going to be next in your career. So being in a large group has its pros and cons. The pros are that you have a lot of people around you. You can talk to, you could vent, strategize, go grab a beer with. You know, the focus was never only on you, but that's the bad part too, is the focus is never only on you. And so you control your destiny in a lot of ways where, you know, you could get lost if you don't, you know, keep up with whatever you set to do that year.
Yeah, and I feel like it's impossible for one PI to keep track of everybody's activities. And so at that point, you can especially get lost if you're not kind of self-organized and self-driven and, you know, have the ability to, like you said, kind of make your own destiny happen, right?
Yeah, go with the flow too. I mean, there were so many times where I felt like I was gonna, you know, hit my head on the wall and just call it quits. But then just step back and like look at the bigger picture. Like, what is this whole team actually like trying to like row towards, you know?
Yeah.
Where are we all trying to go? And then it's like, okay, it's not that bad. I got my teammates here. Where I think is in a small group, sometimes that can feel like all the weight's on you. And you have to do, you know, all these tasks. You have to do all the safety. You have to do all the mentoring. You have to do all the equipment managing. And plus your PhD. So in a big group, you can kind of disperse those efforts, even though you might feel like you're just a number in some cases.
Did you ever feel like it was a competitive environment?
Yeah. In certain cases, I think early on I did more than later. Because early on, I didn't really know what the expectations were for myself, really. Didn't understand, like, what does it take to graduate? Mm-hmm. Which is majority of people's goals that are there. You know, you have postdocs and visiting scholars that they don't have that goal. They're already past that. So once I figured out, you know, my goal is to actually leave here and be successful and, you know, carry on with something else. And once I got that kind of, I was like, it doesn't matter really what I do versus what, you know, my lab mate does, as long as we're both helping each other. But in the beginning, that's tricky because you don't know really what you're, well, at least I didn't. I didn't know what my topic was going to be day one. So, you know, trying to figure that out and, you know, how do I even publish a paper? Like, how do I even put my words down with a graph and make it like, important enough that someone would want to read it or publish it. Once I got over that hurdle, I feel like the competition wasn't really as, at least I didn't feel it as much.
Yeah, that's a really good point about recognizing like the people around you are in different, have different goals and are in different kind of places. I mean, you could say the same thing for like a fourth year grad student to a first year grad student, you know. And some of the people I've had on the show have suggest like one of their pieces of advice is, you know, try not to compare yourself to others, which is hard. It's very hard.
Very hard. Very hard. Yeah. Especially when doing a PhD can be very public.
Yeah.
So you know, you publish a paper, you know, everyone can read about it. You know, you can go and look at your name on that manuscript. So it can be really tricky. And it's a lot of stat-based, you know, academia has a lot of stats that people concentrate on, you know, citations, H index, number of papers, funding, eventually. Impact factor, definitely. so you can get lost in those details and they're distractions, but they definitely, I mean, I think everyone that does a PhD at some point gets lost in that and says like, am I good enough?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, spoiler, we were in the same lab, but I felt similarly in that it wasn't competitive from like a like a top down, like coming from the PI, it wasn't like this is supposed to be a competitive environment. It was more like it was like self-inflicted competition, because it was almost like I want to do cool stuff like that person over there, you know, and it was like, but why? I mean, I'm on a whole different journey, you know, so it was that yeah. kind of internal conversation.
I think it's also natural because we're all high achieving people, and you know, we were on the track of success to even get into the program and to even be considered by, you know, the groups that we were joining. So we're all, you know, we all want to succeed. And so when you're seeing other people succeed, and especially if you feel like you're not succeeding how you would want to, it can be really difficult, especially in the beginning.
Yeah. Completely agree. While we're on this topic, what is there anything you miss about the PhD time of your life?
Yeah, and as I was thinking about this, you know, I really miss the simplicity. I think other people that have been on your podcast have also kind of described this. When you're in the PhD, you feel like nothing is simple because you're in it, but everything is simple. You literally wake up and do research all day, and then you go to sleep.
Yeah.
In the simplest form, that's what you're doing. And it feels consuming because you're doing it all day.
And on your own. It's yours.
And yeah, mostly on your own, you know, maybe the help of your colleagues or your advisor, but mostly on your own. Most of that is on your own. And it might be a 16-hour day.
Yeah.
And now I compare that to my life now, and it is so simple. Yeah. Like now I have to wake up, and I mean, I'm commuting, so I have to commute. I was always commuting in grad school though, too. So it's, but then my day is not me and only me doing research.
Yes. That's the key.
It's, are my budgets okay? Is my team okay? We have enough resources. Did something fail? How's my presentation going? This upcoming meeting. Yeah. I only have 5 minutes to get between buildings. What's for lunch today? Did I eat? Like,
yeah. It's 3 o'clock. Did I eat yet? Yeah.
Yeah. There are just so many things that are going on, and I'm sure if you ask me this question 20 years from now, I'm going to be like, it was so simple then. When I was giving
my first job was so simple.
This podcast. I was only 3 years into my career. It was so easy. but it's true. So I really miss the simplicity of that. I really miss like being able to just grab a cup of coffee and go read a paper. I can still do that now. I still do try to do that now. I still try to carve out moments where I can go and like be more simple, like really strive to do that at my job, but sometimes it's not possible. So that's what I miss.
Yeah. I like framing that as simplicity. I was just trying to explain to someone recently about how, you know, when I was in grad school, like we have some like crazy, like memories from like weekday nights, like going out to the grad student events on like a Thursday night and getting home so late, but then like nobody's looking for you the next day until maybe 10 o'clock. And if you're not there, they don't, you know, it's like, well, whatever, like maybe she'll be here later. I don't know. You know? So there's just this, like you're now, I will say a lot of that experience, I think, improves your ability to be self-managing. And, you know, I think that's the non PhD side of what you learn while doing a PhD is like how to do that, but it's, you know, it's something nice about it.
Definitely. Totally agree. Or just like going to a cafe in the middle of the day.
Yeah,
like I used to do that all the time. I lived in South Philly for the first couple of years of my PhD, and there'd be days I'd be like, I'm just like leaving for lunch and I'm just gonna go chill in a cafe and like write a paper. Yeah. Like,
and nobody cares.
No one cares.
It's you do you. One thing I miss too is like, is when someone in the group had like a weird result and we would all just like sit in the conference room and like draw things on the chalkboard and be like, well, maybe this is what's happening. Like, could it be this? You know, like those conversations. And we were always like not right, but it was just so fun.
Yeah, totally agree.
Okay, so let's move to, so I don't want to like spoiler alert, but you defended right before COVID, correct?
Yes.
What was that like? You were still in person defense, like normal?
Yeah, it was normal. I honestly, it was a great day, but it was very typical. in my defense, you know, went out after that night, which was awesome. It was really fun. And then the next day, I literally watched movies all day because I was so tired.
Yep.
Get home.
Love that.
Yeah. And then I had not gotten an offer. I had not accepted an offer for a job yet. I had been interviewing at that time. So my advisor just basically said, we'll just bring you on as basically a postdoc until you feel that you need to move on or whatever. And so I was like, okay, perfect. So I didn't have any, like, I gotta be done by this day, you know, I gotta wrap things, you know, I knew I had to wrap things up in general and pass the torch, but it was pretty relaxing because I was like, I'm going to go back to the lab this week. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I had been interviewing basically all of January, early February of 2020. And then I accepted a job early February of 2020 and then started at my current position, in March of 2020 at GE in upstate New York. And then 6 days after I started, they basically locked the whole place down and were like, work from home.
Wow.
So that was like, I tell people at work all the time, they're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you, like, you didn't even know anyone. I'm like, I knew no one. I knew nothing. I had no training in the sense of like company training.
Sure.
And I just basically, luckily had a job, but I basically worked from home for 6 weeks analyzing, you know, the project that I had come on to help with, analyzing a bunch of data they had collected over the past couple months. And then was basically begging my manager for opportunities to go back on site and just help whatever team needed help. Like, I was going absolutely crazy being at home analyzing data that I didn't collect or didn't even know how it was collected. And so I found an opportunity, someone needed help, and I was only on site to literally process samples, like something that a technician level position could have probably done perfectly fine. I was doing, and it was totally fine because I just wanted to be there doing something. And it ended up working out really well because that whole team I work with to this day, and about a week or two after I came back to site, the main program that I was working on actually got defunded and postponed in a whole year. So it was like, wow, if I wouldn't have like reached out and said, I want to come back on site, I would have basically been without work. I would have been given more work in a different route, but it worked out. It's really odd how that type of stuff happened. And then
it's you controlling your destiny, you know?
I guess. I don't know.
Without knowing it.
GE was always open. So we were open the whole time. We had really strict protocols, but we were open the whole time. So there was always somebody on site. There was always people making stuff, you know, happen. So went on business as usual, almost, you know, we had a lot of safety protocols and stuff, no in-person meetings or anything like that, but people were in the labs, people were making the work happen, the doers were doing, this is so I like to say, and yeah. We just kept it moving.
So let me get this straight. So you were hired to what would have been a lab research position?
Yeah, and I was hired as a research scientist, which is, it doesn't have to be a PhD level. There are people actually of all backgrounds that are in that position. It just depends on how you get there. But typically, if you're hired directly out of grad school, that position would require a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a it's an independent contributor position, so you can plan your own experiments. You're nested under a program, but you're basically your own person. You would record the data or get help with others through technicians or other people. But you would be responsible for that data and responsible for what you're presenting. So and I was in that role. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say, so the data that you were being asked to analyze, was that data that you were from, like, what, I don't know if you can tell me what kind of data it was, but is it data that you would be familiar with, or were you just, like, kind of being a monkey?
I was analyzing mechanical test data, which I had never seen in my life.
Okay, yeah.
And I was just like, I don't even know, like, I don't have a mechanics background.
Right.
And the role that I was hired into is a ceramics role, which does require mechanics. And I ended up learning a lot about it. And to this day, I'm still, you know, how do I do that experiment? You know, what do we need to consider? You know, I go and look for other people that did PhDs or did masters or just have a lot of experience in mechanical testing.
Yeah.
I was basically analyzing load curves.
Yes.
And I had really never done that other than outside of, like, you know, a mechanical engineering 101 course that, you know, I think I took in, like, undergrad.
Yeah.
So data even itself, I was like, I know how to analyze this because I was instructed how to do it. And I'm checking that I'm doing it correctly with everyone that's collecting the data, but I'm not familiar with this technique.
Yeah. So it's also, like, not, like, intellectually stimulating. So no wonder you were like, I need to go back to the lab to what I'm, like, good at and familiar with.
Yeah. It was like Excel copy and paste for 6 weeks. Oh, and God. I truly was like, I cannot do this. this is like, to me, it was like, I'm dying a slow death. It was awful.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I feel for everybody who onboarded, like, right around that time. And I know plenty, and some of them have been on the show, but it sounds so tough.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that was the absence of the social component, right? Like,
yeah.
You're remotely connected to your manager. You haven't met anyone else who, like, recently started, and you have no idea, like, what your teammates, like, eat for lunch, you know? And
I didn't even know what they looked like.
There was
this point where we were going on site, but we would only go on site to do experiments that were critical, and then we would leave. So I would go on site for a couple hours and then leave, and I would pass people in the hallway, and I have no idea who they are, right? Because I don't know them.
Right. So you're not going to say anything.
They don't know me. They're like random person. And then later on, when we finally were meeting more in person, and we started, like, people started putting pictures of themselves on their team's, like, icon. So, like, you start to be like,
that was a thing.
Look like, I was like, I've been passing you in the hallway for a year, and I work with
you. Oh my God. That's so stressful and awkward. Like,
yeah. So it was unusual, but, I feel like I had some humor with it, with everyone else that was there, and we were just like, it is what it is. We're happy we're just here, and we can still move the research forward, and we still have jobs, and, like, oh well.
So I assume that you are, so now you're in a different group, still ceramics? You're still in ceramics? Or
So I'm in the same group. I am in a different role. So I got promoted this time last year. So instead of it being like a entry level for a PhD, it's just one step above that. And it's called a lead scientist position. And really, I would say the only difference that I have now is just more responsibility. So day to day, just managing a little bit more technical programs, maybe leading one. Instead of just contributing data, like, you know, bringing people together, planning research, scoping research, figuring out who can do the research, training people, mentoring people. So it's just step up, small step up, but it was a step up, and gave me a lot more opportunity to, you know, work on different things, because now my time is more focused on, you know, a broader group of research instead of just like one thing where I do all the experiments.
Have you left electrochemistry behind you?
Oh yeah. I don't do any electrochemistry.
Yeah.
None.
I'm like 5 years out. I was ready to never like talk about batteries ever again.
Yeah.
But it's been 5 years and now I'm like, but I know so much about them, you know? I'm like, when am I going to use that? I don't know. When my grandma tells me that she keeps her batteries in her refrigerator, that's when I use my knowledge.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I like it.
I'm like, let me explain to you why that's not helpful. okay. So how much does what you're doing now relate to what you researched in PhD?
Surface level, nothing. Okay. But when you really step back and look at the broader picture, everything. So surface level, so my PhD was basically researching a class of nanomaterials that are 2D in nature, like graphene, but learning how to process them, especially in solutions, to make inks, to you know, figure out how to cast them, to figure out how to put them on substrates, figure out how we could size select them, things like that. But solution processing. And then I was also looking at optical property characterization. And through all of that, that's surface level. But through all of that, there's a connection between how you synthesize material, how you process the material, what its properties are. And let's collaborate and figure out.
For any material, right?
For any material, right.
Yeah.
And so surface, I don't work on Maxine. I don't work on optical, like surface, the whatever things. But
two-dimensional carbon.
Right. I don't work on two-dimensional nanomaterials. But if I step back and look at it, I'm still working on how do you take a material from what it's made, how it's made, to use it to perform. Yeah. So the thought process around the variables that might be important, the implications of your results, how to analyze the data, how to even design the experiments, they're all the same. So
that's cool.
I'm doing the same thing on a different material system.
You sound very wise. I really, that was very good. That was very good. No, I mean, I followed you that whole time. I was like, yeah, I can see it, because, you know, you learn how to do it on one set of materials and you then can apply it to anything like that. So
yeah,
very cool.
And I mean, now that I work with all these really smart geniuses that have PhDs in all sorts of different topics, even experience, they don't have to have a PhD. I work with a lot of people that don't have PhDs and they are super smart. They have a lot of experience. They know how things work. And if I don't understand something, I can just ask them.
Yeah, they've seen things.
They have.
I know. One day that'll be us.
Yeah, one day.
All right, let me check my questions. What are your... Now that you're like a working person with maybe more free time, but a more complex life, as we've already established, what are your hobbies and things you do besides work?
So I mentioned that Evan and I live in Vermont and we have a 40-acre property. And so we do a lot of hiking with our dog Leo and basically spend every moment that I'm not working and the weather is decent outside.
Nice.
I'm always outside. We love just exploring the area, going to a local park. That's like my favorite thing to do. But I also love gardening. We have a nice garden going every year. And
are you a horticulturist?
Sort of. I plant.
But your plants don't die though, right?
They don't die. unlike Evan's dad, or maybe like Evan's dad.
My God, I remember that.
Oh yeah. That was the best commercial ever.
Yeah.
But we're just outside all the time. I really like craft beer. That's another thing. So going to
Are you
breweries.
brewing?
We're not currently brewing anything, but we love
I think you
going to
have enough
breweries.
space for it.
We do. I definitely do. So maybe eventually that'll be a hobby.
Yeah.
But
Do you ski?
yeah, we don't ski, which is maybe something we should try since
Think
there's so
so.
many ski places. And our last names are both ski. So
Yeah. Ski, ski. Ski, ski for life.
in on the skiing. Yeah.
On the skis.
On the skis.
Yeah, that's my suggestion as a currently someone who lives in Vermont. I think you should check it out.
Yeah, we recently got snowshoes. So last winter got snowshoes. That is
Ooh.
also really fun.
It is fun.
If
It's
you're an
tiring.
avid hiker. Yes. But it makes it so much easier to go through the snow.
Yeah.
So it is
And
tiring,
walking
but
through beautiful, like snow-covered nature is like the best thing. Do you have
Yeah, and
snow now?
we're gonna get chickens in a couple weeks, so
Oh man.
first farm animals.
Do you know who else has chickens? Will
No.
Ferrell.
Oh.
He has a chicken coop. I was just listening to a podcast where he was interviewed on it, and he was like, "I really enjoy like cleaning out the chicken coop and like talking to the chickens and like making their."
Yeah, I'm really excited. It'll be an adventure. We have a barn, so we're actually like building the chicken coop off the barn from a woodshed that we already have on the property. So
Dang.
trying to make it like not a full project, but it'll definitely be somewhat of a project.
A project, yeah.
It'll be a project. We gotta raise the chickens first.
If I know
But
you guys as all, that will become a project. Love that. All right, well, I'm gonna jump to my three wrap-up questions unless you have anything else that you would like to
oh,
share. Okay. So, what is something challenging you faced during your PhD?
oh, I just think about this one. Something that was extremely challenging that I still struggle with is learning how to say no. And it became so bad in my PhD that I was like extremely stressed about it. I had so many things going on and like how to prioritize. I was good at that. I'm good at that in general, like prioritizing things. But when it comes to something that's not my priority, but is somebody else's priority, it's super stressful.
Yeah.
So the most challenging thing for me in my PhD was figuring that out. And like I said, I'm still figuring it out. But I got better at it as the years went on. Like I remember I would wake up in the morning and there would be certain mornings. We had a lot of collaborators overseas that I would
Oh, yeah.
receive more than five emails asking for samples.
Yeah.
And that is awesome. That means that like people like your research. They want to work with you. They want the materials that you produce, but it's also extremely stressful from like, I only have so many hours in a day and so many resources, and I have to do my
Yeah.
own research. Like, I have to graduate.
Yeah, that's
So,
your goal. That's why you're
yeah,
there, right?
every time I'm making samples for you, I am taking away making samples for me. And
Yeah.
there's a pro to that, and it's collaboration. I mean, I got to work with so many people in so many different parts of the world and working on many different topics I would have never even touched through that collaboration. But to figure out where I draw the line and say, no, I have to work on my research today, even though there's these five emails that are like, where's my sample?
Yeah.
That was really challenging. And I got, there was a couple of days where I was just like, I can't do it. I need to go home because I'm just too
Yeah.
stressed. So
Which is
that
tough
was
because
really
you're
challenging.
stressed, so you're not doing either your research or other people's things, you
Yeah,
know?
it was like distracting.
It's like
So
paralysis.
yeah, like the emails these days, there's just so many emails. And just figuring out how to filter those for your priority lists, you know, and like setting a priority for you for that quarter was how I got through that. So I was like, this quarter, personally, I want to focus on blank for my thesis. And then like three things, like three collaborative projects that I really wanted to move forward, like really heavily. Hmm. And that was it. I didn't have time for those four things in a day. Well, then I'm too overbooked. And if I do have time for things past that, then I can do somebody else's sample. Hmm. So
that's cool. I learned two things. I think one was to not check my phone when I woke up in the middle of the night, which was like huge, because even if it wasn't like an international collaborator, if it was like someone from our group or like our advisor or whatever, I just didn't need to read that and feel stressed at 2 a.m. You know, it could wait until I woke up for real. So
yeah, that's a nice part too. Like in industry, majority of the time you're not connected to your work email. And you're choosing if you are. Right. I'm not. I have a totally different work device. Most of the time I turn my computer off when I leave work and it doesn't get turned on till the next day.
Wow.
So
it's good.
I do not get connected.
That's good. That divide is good. It's healthy. The other thing that I learned, because I had the same problem as you, right? Saying no. I learned to say, instead of yes, but not now. Mm. So I'd be like, yes, I really want to do this for you, but here are the things I need to get done first. And then, I mean, I wouldn't lay them out, but I'd be like, here's where you land on my priority list, you know? And especially if people come to you and they're like, I need this now because I am like behind. I'd be like, well, look, your inability to plan is not like, should not be my burden. Right. But exactly. That's so hard to learn. And like, I think maybe I learned it like in my fifth year.
Yeah. I struggled with it until the end. And I mean, I'm, like I said, I'm still struggling with it in a lot of ways. So work in progress.
Things we learn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good answer. Good conversation. Next question. What advice would you give to yourself in your first year-ish?
Yeah. This was another one I had a couple that I was like, I could say a couple things. The main one, though, is don't sweat the small stuff.
Because
it's so small. It is so small. Like it doesn't matter.
Give me an example.
So
like a failed experiment.
Like I used to get nervous when I had to present at group meeting.
Mm.
I mean, and that's rightful. Like you can be nervous before a presentation. That means that you want to be prepared.
You care.
That you care, that you want, that you're focused on your delivery. But I was so nervous about it.
Yeah.
Like, what are they going to think of me? I didn't get that sample completely done. Oh no. Like, what about that data point? It's a little off. It's kind of like an outlier, but I don't know why it's an outlier. Like,
yeah,
all of those things, they do matter. But the point that you're focusing that much on it means that you're in the right spot, because you should focus that much on your data. But in general, it doesn't actually matter that much. And most of the time when it goes to a publication or, you know, a final presentation, maybe for like a defense or something, that outlier data point is like so long gone that it was like a one-off experiment and you dropped that thing like 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And it does matter. You can be nervous, but don't sweat it so much that it makes you not do like have a good day.
Like, prioritize your mental health over that stress, ideally.
Yeah. And just it doesn't have to be perfect. It's
mm-hmm.
the data perfection. Is data.
That's a good one, is experiment. Sweat perfection.
Yeah, like the experiment that you have organized and conducted and executed is going to be the data that it is. And
yeah.
And it's not your fault if there's an outlier.
Hmm. It's good. It's a good one. That's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
All right, last question. To end on a good note, do you have a good memory or story you would like to share?
Yeah. I had so many good memories, like going out after like a hard day and like just blowing off steam, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think some of the best memories I have from grad school are just opportunities that I got to travel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even grad school at that point. Like, you're on your own traveling somewhere new. And that opportunity was only because you were in grad school.
Yeah.
And my example that I was thinking most about was I went to South Korea twice. And I spent 2 summers there. And before I had went to South Korea, I had traveled abroad once in my life, I think. And I had went to Europe with a bunch of my lacrosse teammates. We played lacrosse in Europe. And going to South Korea by myself, I had a lot of preconceptions about what Asia was and like what I was going to, like my environment that I was going to be in. I was kind of like unsure about it. I went there and the people were so nice and welcoming, and the environment was tricky because I was in a clean room and I couldn't really speak the language completely, and there was a lot of learning to do, but it was a fond memory because I grew a lot from that experience. Mm-hmm. Like, I became independent because I had to be, and I had to figure out how to convince people that my research was important even though they weren't going to benefit.
Mm.
And so I look fondly on those times, even though that was probably the most stress I've ever been in my life when I was over there.
Was the second time less stressful?
Yes. Second time was way less stressful. First time, though, it was like, I'm the only one here. And like, I don't even, like, no one speaks English.
Yeah.
But
like, looking back, like, what a cool experience to have in your 20s, you know?
Yes.
And like, even working like a normal industry job now, like those opportunities are few and far between.
I was like living on campus, which was great. It was good for that time in my life. But the second year I actually requested to live in the village. So I was living above a mart. There was like a shop below and I was living basically above that. Like a group of apartments above that. And that was just totally awesome. There was communal kitchens and I ate dinner with like my neighbors and like, we didn't speak the same language, but we spoke the same, like we were all humans food. And we all like, we were like, oh, this is great food, you know? And like people were playing soccer in the streets. Like they had like a little like pickup soccer game at night. And I'm like, yes, this is great. Like, I don't need to speak English to play soccer.
True.
So it was a really good experience, like being in the village, and like it was right next to campus. Like the walk was just a little longer. I grew a lot as a person when I was over there, a researcher and a person.
Yeah. That's great. I feel like looking back on it too, when you have some distance from an experience like that, you really see those positive things too. While still recognizing the stress that you felt and the fear.
Yes.
Yeah. Very cool. All right. Well, that about wraps it up. Anything you want
to plug?
I'll plug for you that Kathleen was just named one of Drexel's 40 under 40, which I don't know what that means, but it seems legit.
Yeah. I'm excited and I'm really grateful for, you know, all my colleagues' support and like all the people that I've worked with over the years. I mean, that's like really like a 40 under 40 is like, it's not just you. It's like,
yeah,
everyone that has been a part of your career and your family and your friends. So I'm just so grateful that I was in a good space and had so many opportunities.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, congrats on that.
Thank you.
Congrats on your chickens.
Yeah.
Important. Yes. And thanks so much for coming on the show. It was nice to catch up and hear your wisdom.
I appreciate it, and I'm just so grateful that I was able to be here.
Thanks to Kathleen for coming on the show. If you or someone you know wants to be interviewed on Impact Factor, feel free to reach out via Instagram and follow us for updates at Impact Factor Pod. Thank you all for listening, and have a great week.